Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the make or break moment for Mitt Romney with the Michigan Republican primary where the polls have just closed and we will announce results as they come in. A former long-serving executive with General Motors, Debbie Dingell, joins us. She is the president of D2 Strategies and chair of the Manufacturing Initiative of the American Automobile Policy Council, and we will discuss the fate of Michigan's own Mitt, who campaigned on his opposition to President Obama's initiatives to rescue Chrysler and General Motors from bankruptcy. Then we will speak with Michael Singh, the filmmaker of a new PBS feature documentary, Valentino's Ghost, that explores the ways images of Arabs and Muslims have been portrayed in movies, starting with Rudolph Valentino's The Sheik, up to the present, where an Iranian film, The Separation, just won the Academy Award, with its director in accepting the Oscar, making an appeal for the medium of film to be used to generate greater cultural empathy and understanding at a time when rumors of war abound. Then finally, we will discuss the leading role Saudi Arabia is taking in trying to overthrow Syria's brutal Assad regime on humanitarian grounds, which, given the repressive nature of the absolute monarchy that rules Saudi Arabia, many see as hypocritical. Toby Jones, a professor of Middle East history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia, joins us. Joining us now is Debbie Dingell, the president of D2 Strategies and chair of the Manufacturing Initiative of the American Automotive Policy Council. She worked for more than 30 years at General Motors as a senior executive, has served as vice chairman of the General Motors Foundation, and as executive director of global community relations and government relations at GM. Welcome to Background Briefing, Debbie Dingell.
Hey, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And you're a genuine Michigander, it would seem.
I am born and bred, auto industry in my blood.
So does Mitt Romney.
It's true.
Why did he write that op-ed then? Why did he come out of the gate opposing the so-called bailout? And frankly, the bailout is not really what it is. We should begin with that, right?
That absolutely is correct. It was at a time saving the domestic auto industry that had the government not taken the action that it had, it would have had devastating economic consequences across this country. I don't know why he did what he did. It's very hard to understand why he did, and quite frankly, to understand why in the last couple of weeks that he's been in Michigan, why he has continued to take the stand that he did or attack labor so heavily. Governor Snyder, Republican governor of Michigan, doesn't look back but says, it works, let's move ahead.
So it's true that I take it, Debbie Dingell, that there is that Mitt Romney's father was quite popular, right? And he's tried to sort of maintain that or at least use those coattails of his father's legacy. But I'm just wondering about this stance that he's taken against the President Obama's efforts to. Well, since you've worked for GM, let's just clarify exactly what happened there. My understanding is that had the president not intervened, GM and Chrysler would have gone into bankruptcy, and there was no private equity available, and this was a choice that had to be made, and that, frankly, it's not a bailout because both Chrysler and General Motors are paying it back. And isn't it pretty clear that General Motors is having an incredibly good year with their products back on the market and being quite popular?
All of that, you've done a good description of it, Ian, in describing what happened. Governor Romney has said that what he wanted was a bankruptcy and that it should have been private funding. But if you recall the state that the government was in, or the economy was in at the time, there was not that kind of funding available from any of the banks. That money wasn't available. So the only source of funding that was necessary, that was critical and necessary for both General Motors and Chrysler came from the government. And the fact of the matter is that Chrysler has repaid the loan, General Motors has repaid the loan, the government still has equity in General Motors, but it's fully anticipated that the government will get their money back before this is all over. And the jobs that have been saved across the country, in community after community, not just in Michigan, but in every state across the country. All 50 states would have been impacted by the demise of this domestic industry. And the fact of the matter is that in the last, we've seen 200,000 jobs added in the last 18 months. You've got all three companies are adding three shifts. You've seen, for the first time, you've seen job growth in the auto industry since 1994. You're seeing positive signs that happened because the government helped these two companies survive.
And Debbie Dingell, does the demonizing of the big unions and the big union bosses that Romney's engaging in, referring, of course, to the UAW, that doesn't seem to ring true when you look at the deal that was made. You know, the older workers maintain their pay and their benefits, but new workers, entry level workers, are paid as little as $14 an hour. So that doesn't strike me as a huge victory for big union bosses.
What I don't understand is why Governor Romney has been attacking labor so intensely. The fact of the matter is that everybody came to the table, and union workers made significant concessions, gave up contracts were renewed, retirees gave up health care benefits. There were cuts in salary or in the income of the union workers. There were significant concessions made by everybody so that everybody could succeed, that people could help their fellow workers and to save this industry. And what the president was doing was protecting people's pensions, their health care benefits, etc. That's all. We're saving and helping everyday working men and women is not selling out to labor.
So in other words, had it gone bankrupt, it could have gone the way of some of the airline companies who have been able to break their union contracts and literally, you know, either abandon the pension obligations or in that some cases loot them.
That is absolutely correct.
So
these people worked a lifetime.
So Debbie Dingell, again, the president of D2 Strategies and chair of the Manufacturing Initiative of the American Automotive Policy Council. What is happening then with the rural? I mean, it's hard to understand the stance that Romney's taken, but maybe the argument would be, well, you know, the very conservative Republican voters in the state might well agree with him over not rescuing GM and Chrysler. Hard to believe, but perhaps there's some evidence for that. But my understanding is that in the rural parts of Michigan, where there's a lot of appeal for hunting and gun ownership, and your husband, the longest serving congressman in the House, is on the board of the NRA, John Dingell. My understanding is that the NRA in Michigan has come out strongly for Santorum and against Romney. And would that be a factor?
Well,
do you think?
Yes, my husband was on the board of the NRA. He is not on the board of the NRA now. The NRA came out very strongly for Senator Santorum in the last few days. I was actually surprised at how strong the message was, telling people that Senator Santorum had an A-plus rating, but that if they cared about their gun rights, that supporting used words that Mitt Romney had given at one point, saying that he did not support the NRA on many occasions, and said that a vote for Mitt Romney would be destroying gun owners' rights, which surprised me at the strength of the negative message that they had. And yes, the NRA is known for turning out its voters. The passion of the message was very strong, and it was likely to send NRA members to the polls.
And isn't that pretty much the breakdown in Michigan? You've got rural Michigan that's very Republican and conservative, and urban Michigan that's Democrat?
Well, it's probably not quite that simple, but the fact of the matter is that the middle part of Michigan and the upper part of Michigan and the upper peninsula probably tend to be more conservative. In 2008, you saw a very strong Democratic year. In 2010, the Republicans took every statewide seat in the state and took control of both the state house and the state senate back. What's not clear is what kind of election year this year is going to be. I think voters want to see people that are going to work and get along. You do have Republican areas in the southeastern Michigan, and you have Democratic areas. So what the question today is, who turned out and what kind of voter were they? I do think that there are voters in southeastern Michigan that are Romney supporters who turned out, and I think there are voters in other parts of Michigan that are more conservative and turned out. I think it's going to be a very close night tonight.
So do you think then that much of what Santorum has been campaigning on lately, the social issues, bringing up something that a lot of women thought was already, you know, in the past, and that is contraception, his contemptuous remarks about both President Kennedy and President Obama vis-a-vis an alleged elitism, because the president's remarks about Americans needing a college education, and which he, of course, meant that also can include trade schools and vocational training, etc. But that was used by Santorum to say that he was a snob. And he was making remarks, frankly, to my mind, that with homeschooling and the other things that he's pushing, that make it sound like an American madrasa. I mean, I'm just wondering whether a lot of the stuff that he's been coming out with has hurt him, one would think, with Republican women. But on the other hand, you know, maybe he's doing well. I just don't understand. I'd like your input on that.
I think it's been very, very complicated. I think Senator Santorum has certainly, there are many Republican women that have had some issues with some of the statements that have been said in the last few days. By the way, Governor Romney himself has made some off-the-cuff comments that have stepped in it a bit, too. So they both made some gaffes in the last few days. There are people that agree with Senator Santorum, and there are people that disagree. I think Republican women have had some major issues with some of the things that have happened in the last couple of weeks in terms of public policy in this country. I'm not sure that those Republican women are voting. I think that you are seeing those who have some very conservative feelings being the ones that are turning out at the poll thinking that they can make a difference.
So as a Democrat, I assume you're a Democrat. At least you're married to one.
I am a Democrat. Democratic National Committee member.
So what about this notion that that, and of course it's come up in this race because of Santorum encouraging Democrats to vote for him, the idea that what would motivate Democrats to vote for him was that that Santorum would be an easier candidate for the president to run against than Mitt Romney. What's your feelings on that? Because just if I can express my own, I think in many ways it might be good for this country to have a debate between President Obama and this very, very conservative Republican, because it would finally sort of bring out these issues about democracy versus theocracy, and really it would gauge the true strength of the religious right in this country, which has dominated the Republican Party, and it may well prove that its bark is worse than its bite.
I think that's a complicated question. I think that Mitt Romney, Governor Romney, would be a stronger general election candidate for the Republicans. I do believe that. I think the economy and jobs is what November is ultimately going to be about, and that Governor Romney is stronger there. I think Senator Santorum has not been subject to some of the national scrutiny that Governor Romney has seen, not just in this election cycle, but was a serious candidate for president 4 years ago. Senator Santorum has made some statements that will be very controversial if they become more public. I also am somebody who thinks we need to be Americans first and Republicans and Democrats second. I think the last few years we are too divided as a country, and I want to see us pull together, not tear us apart. I wouldn't like a President Obama-Senator Santorum election because I think this country's got to start to come together, not continue to be divided.
Well, I thank you for joining us here. Obviously, we don't know anything at this point, except that it's going to be a very, very close race. And I thank you for joining us, Debbie Dingell.
Thank you. And it's been an honor to be with you. And we'll see what happens later tonight.
Again, I've been speaking with Debbie Dingell, who's the president of D2 Strategies and chair of the Manufacturing Initiative of the American Automotive Policy Council. She worked for more than 30 years at General Motors as a senior executive, has served as vice chairman of the General Motors Foundation and as executive director of global community relations and government relations at GM. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the filmmaker of the new film, Valentino's Ghost.
Since the first of June, lost my job and lost my room. I pretend to try, even if I try.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Singh, the writer, producer, and director of the new film, Valentino's Ghost. This just released feature-length documentary film has a number of experts who explore the ways in which the image of Arabs and Muslims in the U.S. media have evolved over time and reflecting American foreign policies, America's foreign policy agenda in the Middle East. Michael is half American, half Punjabi, and his other films include Good Sharma, The Prisoner's Song, Uncommon Journeys, Riding the Tiger, and The Rebel Queen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Singh.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And the film, of course, is narrated by Mike Farrell, who's very much a friend of KPFK, I might add, and features a number of Middle East experts. So it starts out and it's punctuated by contemporary comedians. Is that the sort of sugar on the bitter pill, Michael?
Well, it could be seen as comic relief, but they themselves are pretty bitter in their antics. And they're sarcastic and they're using humor in to, I guess, overcome the pain that they feel. Living in the United States as a man of Middle Eastern heritage, and we thought that humor was also a good way to convey sometimes an uncomfortable storyline that Americans aren't used to.
So why is it then, Michael, that the narrative is different? At least it's questioned in Europe and England and other places, and I think to some extent the unconditional support for Israel is starting to fray a little in the contemporary situation over the obvious impulse on the part of Netanyahu to want to have war with Iran and against the wishes of the U.S. and his refusal to basically tell the U.S. that he's not going to do it. And we know that's going to come to head next week when Netanyahu visits for the APEC conference. Since you've been, you know, obviously born in India and been in Europe and here in the United States, what's your explanation? I know the film touches on a little bit, showing some of the British celebrities supporting the Palestinians and asking the question, why is it that American celebrities don't do so?
Well, there's an anti-intellectual tradition in this country that goes all the way back to its formation. You're just not allowed to be too smart here. I mean, I think that's what Obama is guilty of as well. But There is that, and so there is a lack of knowledge about other parts of the world and history. Whereas in Europe and in Israel itself, there's a lot of criticism of Israel because there is a knowledge of the history of that country. Here there isn't so much of that. And I think that there is a passionate belief in the saintliness of Israel amongst evangelical Christians. I think more so than most Jewish Americans, is the evangelical Christians are absolutely determined that this is the beginning of the second coming. It's the big sign.
Right, so, but they only want to use the Israelis or the Jews as a means in which to bring about the end of the world, which means that our world will end in burning flesh for their world to begin, and lakes of fire and rivers of blood and all of that spiritual pornography that they seem to be obsessed with. And the bottom line is that the Reverend Hagees and company, who are in your film, they just want to use the Jews in order to end the world, right?
Well, sure, and the Jews are going to have to decide whether to convert or be, incinerated from their vision. And I think that there is a certain part of Ahmadinejad's apocalyptic vision about the prophets coming down, and in fact, in his version, Jesus is going to be present as well. So I'm not sure who gets to get the real Jesus. Is it going to be the Ahmadinejad side or the Hagees side? But he's going to have to be in one place, I think.
Well, there is, of course, you absolutely put your finger on it, Michael, saying there is this really deeply ironic similarity between Ahmadinejad's messianic beliefs of the hidden imam returning, the Messiah returning, and he sends notes down to the wells in Gorm to the Messiah. He's a complete religious nut, but, how different is he from Hagee and company?
Not much different, except that he is of the wrong color, and that's a big problem. He's got the wrong God, and we have the right God. And so I think people with religious fervor can become, Taliban-esque. I think that's the most succinct way to describe it here in this country.
Well, that's not to say, though, that I was just doing, I just did an interview the other day with somebody that spent a lot of time in Afghanistan as a UN political officer, and she speaks Hindi, Dari, Pashto, Urdu, all of the local languages in that part of the world, and really does, I think, know what she's talking about. And we're talking about the burning of the Qurans, and she pointed out the absolute hypocrisy of much of those sort of Sunni Salafists who are all raging there in the streets about the burned Quran. But in Pakistan, on a regular basis, the same Salafists burn Shia mosques and not only burn the Qurans, but burn the people.
Yes. Yeah, there is that hypocrisy there, but that's, I think, part of the tradition of documentary filmmaking is to point out as dispassionately as you can the hypocrisies that you see around you, and this is the one that I saw and wanted to have an evidence-based film, and that's why we have all these film clips and all the experts looking at the evidence rather than giving their opinions. They're trying to frame the images in the historical context, and that is what has upset quite a few people. But I do hope that your listeners will maybe even call their local PBS affiliates and try to persuade them that this is not a screed, and actually it may increase viewership, in my opinion. I mean, our biggest private funder, I think this can be made public, is a Jewish organization, the Skirball Foundation, because they understand the damages of ethnic stereotyping. Any Jew who knows history can tell you about that. So I don't think that their fears are well-founded, and I think that, yes, the film does veer from the national narrative, but perhaps it's time for that, and there may be many potential PBS members out there who will join based on films such as these.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Singh, the writer, producer, and director of the new film Valentino's Ghost, just released a feature-length documentary with experts who explore ways in which images of Arabs and Muslims in the U.S. media mirror American foreign policy as it's evolved over time. So it seems to me, Michael Singh, that what you mentioned earlier was very much on point, and that is that the real enemy is sort of anti-intellectualism, and quite often, particularly in this current political race, one can't help feeling that some of it's coming out here, Rick Santorum suggesting that it's elitist to go to college. He homeschools, which, in many ways is a kind of a mirror of the Christian madrasas.
Yes, yes.
And I know that one of the great ironies, of course, of the so-called war on terror has been that no Christian or Jew could dissuade an Islamist from becoming a radical. The only person who could do that would be a moderate Islamist. And they're the very people that our policies and actions since 9/11 have alienated and stigmatized. You just have to look at what happened when Santorums and the Gingriches are now railing about the President Obama having a war on religion, and Fox News, of course, is stirring the pot there. I recall that Fox News was stirring the pot on the so-called Ground Zero Mosque. So, again, it seems incredibly selective that we can't, you know, we talk about the First Amendment and protecting religion against the state, but it seems that we're very selective about what religions we protect.
Well, I think so, and I think that it's very important for American politicians to wear their religion on their sleeve, as opposed to in Europe and in Britain, where I think that would be almost an embarrassment. Here, you have to have a channel to God, and God is allowed to speak to you and will speak to you. So there's almost a prophet-like status that politicians here bestow upon themselves, and that, I think, helps to reassure an audience that may not know a lot about world history. I mean, you mentioned 9/11. If there is no knowledge of world history, then 9/11 will seem as if it was something that came out of the blue for no reason. And that is how it was described. Whereas if you look at the animosities of the Middle Eastern peoples towards the U.S., you will see that they began at the same time that the U.S. started meddling in the Middle East. And so it just became striking back in wider and wider circles until finally the circle reached the shores of the United States. But it was nothing new in that sense at all. It was just on a larger scale, and it was part of a continuum. That's what we tried to show in this film. But the anti-intellectualism is what blocks that kind of perspective, the high perspective looking down. And Santorum and his minions, I think, are very good at tapping into that and holding up the Bible as, you know, the main font of wisdom, which is, of course, a mirror of the madrasas, as you mentioned, in Muslim countries, where the Quran is held up as the alpha and the omega. So these are, you can't challenge folks who get their marching orders from God. You just can't.
Well, clearly you're using the medium of film here to try and get this much-needed message out about how we have portrayed so much of the Middle East over the, starting, of course, with Valentino back in 1926, all the way up to the present, and with experts and historians of the Middle East, as well as the punctuation from contemporary Arab and Iranian-American comedians who, as you mentioned earlier, in many ways their comedy has a hard edge because they're describing being hassled at airports, etc., and the sort of subtext of being Middle Eastern equals being a terrorist. I was very, very struck, though, Michael, by what happened a couple of nights ago at the Academy Awards, when that extraordinary Iranian film, Separation, won for Best Foreign Film. And I thought the speech by the director was very, very powerful and very moving. And it sort of really gives one hope that the medium of the movies can actually be used to heal so much of the ignorance and dogma that we're talking about here today, in the sense that both the film, The Separation itself, was such a subtle and beautiful piece of filmmaking that dealt with the human condition, and the filmmaker's speech transcended nations and tried to reach across from people to people in obviously a climate in which it's not inconceivable that the United States will be dragged into a war against Iran quite soon.
And imagery will be used if that happens, just as it was used to drag people into Iraq. Saddam Hussein, of course, was behind 9/11, according to that narrative, and that worked. There was a time when a lot of people believed that, and the same thing could work here. So I agree with you Asghar, I think Farhadi is his name, appealed to love, which is so astonishing and optimistic, and I don't think it's a coincidence that love is also a New Testament order, almost. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Now, such things are very quickly forgotten amongst practicing Christians. But if you go back to the actual text, you will see that it's there. And he is, I think, appealing to a basic human emotion that is far deeper than any religion can claim. And, I mean, the Beatles and rock and roll wrote about love. So for him to bring that into the conversation, I think, was just, it was heartbreaking, and at the same time, it was inspiring. And why not use imagery, I think he was saying, to try to have a conversation and to try to heal wounds rather than be divisive?
Well, there's no question that the analogies, I think, are quite disturbing between the run-up to the Iraq War and the drumbeat towards a war with Iran. It's exactly the same methodology. And we've seen that movie before, and hopefully people won't be suckered this time. And it seems that the White House is not buying it as well. But to your other point, just in closing, Michael Singh, it seems to me that the perversion of religion, or at least the usurpation of religion, particularly in this country where the Prince of Peace and the Prophet Jesus, who after all did not carry an AK-47, he didn't hate homosexuals, he didn't celebrate capital punishment. In fact, he ministered to the poor and the downtrodden, and in many ways was a socialist revolutionary. It seems to me that he's become a front for right-wing politics, that, the Christian right. It's hard to see where their theology begins and where their politics end. And in many ways, it seems to me that the common problem we have here, whether it's the right wing in Israel under Netanyahu, the right wing here with the Santorums and the Gingriches, the right wing has taken over in Iran. That's what Ahmadinejad and the supreme leader are in the political lexicon. Isn't that a better way to look at things?
Isn't what a better way to look at things?
Well, in other words, not to look at them in a religious context, but in a kind of political context. The real problem is right-wing politics, which, translates where religion is just used as a decoration for right-wing politics.
Well, I believe there are two political... you may have heard this joke before. There are two political parties in the United States. There's the right wing, and there's the far right wing. And that is how I see it. And I think politics is exactly the way to look at it, and that's why we looked at it in our film with through political lenses, with commentators like Mearsheimer and Fisk. And that is, in my opinion, the only way to get deep into imagery, is to look at the political context behind it. Why were they created? Who created them? And what was the effect that was intended? That is how Saddam Hussein was successfully blamed for 9/11. That is how the non-existent weapons of mass destruction were a catalyst for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, is through imagery. And the politicization of imagery is what we are trying to get to the bottom of, to make people more aware that every image that you see, there is something political underneath it that is pushing it out to you, and there are reasons for it. There are reasons for movies to come out that are political, and they are not going to be discussed. They are not going to be dissected. The people in Valentino's Ghost do that kind of dissection and reveal the politics behind those images and the intentions of the image creators. And the more you reveal the intentions of creators of imagery, the less power they have over you. And so we are hoping that this film will be an empowering vehicle for people who watch it, and they will learn that it isn't just about images of Arabs and Muslims, but it's about the factory of imagery that is used, and very, very skillfully. If you look at propaganda from even as late as World War II, it looks naive to us, but it was sophisticated for its age. Very intelligent people bought into it. The same thing will happen 50 years from now when people look at the propaganda machines that are working overtime with us, not just with Iran, but of course with, you know, 10 years ago with Saddam Hussein. These propaganda machines are not, they don't label themselves as such. And Hollywood is definitely, you know, part of that. That's why the whole film is to show with evidence that the imagery that is coming out of Hollywood, we show that the imagery coming out of Hollywood is empirically, if you look at it, evidence-based, it is in lockstep with our Washington, D.C. power brokers. If we want to make friends with a country, Hollywood will accommodate you. If you want to make enemies with a country, Hollywood will accommodate you. These are not opinions. These are the facts, as they can be easily unearthed by anybody.
Well, Michael Singh, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new film, Valentino's Ghost.
Thank you so much for your time. I really am very grateful for being able to disseminate this on your show.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Singh, the writer, producer, and director of the new film Valentino's Ghost, just released a feature-length documentary film in which experts explore the ways in which the images of Arab and Muslims in the U.S. media mirror America's foreign policy agenda in the Middle East. He's also made films such as Good Sharma, The Prisoner's Song, Uncommon Journeys, Riding the Tiger, and The Rebel Queen. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Saudi Arabian hypocrisy.
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Jones, a professor of Middle East history at Rutgers University and the author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. His work focuses primarily on the political intersections between science, technology, the environment, knowledge production, and the state formation, war, and Islamism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Jones.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And clearly, Saudi Arabia is taking the lead along with Qatar in trying to get rid of the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And I believe that, I don't know how much covert money and covert arms are slipping in, but my understanding is that the Qataris have actually provided a brigade that was trained in Libya. It does seem that we're heading towards a civil war there. But what's so hypocritical, it seems, is the idea that the Saudi Arabians are the champions of rushing to the aid of those abused by dictators when they routinely repress their own people.
That's right. They repress their own people. They repress their neighbors' people. And remember, it was just a year ago. It'll be a year ago on March 14th. Saudi Arabia sent a military contingent into Bahrain to quell a pro-democracy uprising there. So I think you're certainly right to identify a kind of paradox, contradiction in the Saudi position in calling for an end to the bloodshed and suffering that the Syrians are enduring at the hands of a brutal tyrant. But it would be a mistake to conclude that the Saudis are either sympathetic with the interests of Syrian revolutionaries, that they seek to see a democratic outcome there, or that they're even a little bit concerned about humanitarian issues or suffering. Now, the Saudis have a political agenda, and winning Syria for the Saudis is all about winning the regional balance of power game. Checking Iranian ambition, creating a weak regime in Damascus is probably Riyadh's primary objective. Certainly not preventing a civil war or aiding the cause of those in Syria, like in Homs, who are suffering terribly.
And Toby Jones, during the Egyptian Revolution, the Saudi king was on the phone every day screaming at President Obama to allow Mubarak to kill the kids in Tahrir Square and to quash the revolution. And of course, obviously the president didn't listen to him. And the long and the short of it is, how have the Saudi royals managed to avoid the Arab Spring? Because clearly, given their position vis-a-vis supporting Musharraf and the extent to which they funded the Salafists in Egypt now, who have done very well in the elections, clearly they are the royal family are terrified of the Arab Spring.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, when events, when Egypt didn't do, went through its stages of protest, 18 days of protest last year, and when Mubarak fell, of course, the Saudis were terrified. I mean, there was a deep sense of anxiety in Riyadh about what this might portend. It was also last February that events in Syria and Yemen and Bahrain broke out. So they certainly felt besieged. And it's been the pattern of Saudi behavior over the last year to pursue more or less a counter-revolutionary agenda. That might seem at odds with how they're claiming to support the revolution in Syria or even the role that they played in Libya. But those still, I believe, and would argue, fit the model, or at least are consistent with Saudi Arabia's desire to crush democratic movements in the region and to turn them into something else or to defeat them. And you're right, in Egypt, of course, Saudi Arabia was terrified and was deeply unnerved by the prospect of Mubarak falling and wanted to see him do whatever it would take to stay in power. It's also interesting that in the post-Mubarak Egypt, that Riyadh, while the Saudis are certainly ideologically inclined to support some sectors of the religious establishment in Egypt, Salafis and others, they're also throwing their weight behind the military regime because they believe that's the ticket to stability. And the kind of Mubarakism without Mubarak is certainly something the Saudis would like to preserve. Closer to home, the Saudis have used a number of different instruments, everything from coercion and the use of violence against their own protest movement, which is actually pretty significant in some parts of the country, as well as a set of inducements using a ton of money. Over the course of 2011, the Saudis pledged somewhere on the order of $130 to $140 billion in new spending, designed to address the sorts of social despair and social frustrations that a lot of its citizens harbor. I mean, this is a place, in spite of considerable oil wealth and considerable oil reserves, has upwards of 20% unemployment and upwards of 20% who live below the line of poverty. So certainly the conditions in Saudi Arabia are there for it to see or to experience the Arab Spring as well. It just hasn't happened yet.
Well, apparently the Saudi population is growing rapidly. I believe it's up to 28 million now, and it's a very young demographic we're talking about. And my understanding is even though there hasn't been very good polling and the Saudis basically protect their image and the press seem to sort of pretty much get spoon-fed what the government wants. My understanding, and maybe it's biased because it comes from some of the Saudi opposition figures, is that the young people in Saudi Arabia are extremely restless and repressed. And if there were to be an Arab Spring, it would have a very secular nature in Saudi Arabia.
Well, I wouldn't want to predict what the character of the uprising would be. I think on the one hand, I think if there was going to be one, so let's say a hypothetical uprising, a revolutionary movement in Saudi Arabia, what would it look like? I think you're right to identify a deep sense of disillusion in some sectors of Saudi society, whether it's a generational issue or whether it's a regional issue. Remember, Saudi Arabia is a huge place, roughly one-third the size of the United States, and there's geographic variety, there's There's cultural and religious variety and complexity within Saudi Arabia. And that could be a potential strength. Not all Saudis for a revolutionary movement. Not all Saudis identify either with the Al-Saud or with the brand of Islamic orthodoxy that they promote and embrace officially. So there's a lot of bristling against Saudi political authority, against corruption, against excess, against violence. But for the very same reason that there's complexity in Saudi Arabia, it also makes a revolutionary movement difficult to pull off logistically. I mean, the organizational effort that would have to go into an Egyptian-style uprising or even a Bahraini-style uprising would be significant. Saudis would have to overcome a powerful security apparatus, but also geography. I mean, far distant cities with different social and cultural traditions and relationships. And in some way, Saudi Arabian society is deeply atomized and divided. And Saudis have to figure out a way, if in fact the vast majority want this, they have to figure out a way to overcome all of that to pursue political change. And that would have to happen before you'd see large street protests in the kingdom.
Well, it seems to me, though, Toby Jones, that the using the Wahhabi religious police, the Mutawahin, the House of Saud essentially uses them as a form of control over the population. Not that the House of Saud don't also have their own police and military and intelligence organs as well. In fact, the next leader may well be the fellow in charge of that apparatus. But my understanding is, and the reason I suggested maybe there's a kind of secular reaction to this religious oppression, is that if you essentially control people's lives in the way that the religious police do, to the point where, you know, women can't drive, they're essentially obsessed with the your body. You can't date. You can't do just about anything. It's a lot what a lot of feminists say about the attempts on the part of religious rights to the religious right in this country to control their body, is that once you control, if you control somebody's body, you control them totally, or you control their mind. Is that do you follow my train of thought here? I know I'm rambling a little, but
no, I think that's right. I think there are a number of sources of frustration, and certainly the social control, the effort by central authorities in collusion with religious authorities to both project a kind of morality and to claim credibility and legitimacy based on religious grounds, and then to use that claim to legitimacy as an instrument of social control certainly generates all kinds of frustration. But over the last 30 years or so, and this is not something that should be discounted, in addition to what we might identify as liberal or secular forces of opposition, and they certainly exist, it's not a perfect way to describe what goes on in Saudi Arabia, but for the convenience of kind of, you know, as a shorthand, it does make sense in this conversation to say that there are liberal secular forces in Saudi Arabia that oppose efforts of social control. But there are also, pious Muslims who identify both politically and religiously along, a different kind, they embrace a different kind of Islamic philosophy or interpretation, are also mobilized for precisely those reasons, that they're not Wahhabis. They could be Shiites. They could be non-Salafi Sunnis. They could be anything. They could even be Salafi Sunnis. And they oppose the kinds of measures and injunctions that are dictated by the Saudi state and by the religious authorities, the religious police included. So what I'm suggesting is that, yes, there is, I think you're absolutely right, that there is an avowedly liberal strain within the Saudi political opposition, but there's also an Islamist strain to it, and we should, it's not like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but it's also maybe not too far distant from that. And, that has the power to be revolutionary. We may not think it's progressive, but it has the power to be revolutionary anyway.
So, Toby Jones, are you referring to the more the broader kind of more inclusive and less xenophobic and austere form of Islam because the Wahhabis are relatively recent, and Mecca and Medina were traditionally had a much broader menu, if you will, of Islamic traditions, and the Wahhabis essentially have dominated Islam, and they've, I think, in many ways, arguably, they've had a pretty detrimental effect throughout the world. They've, after all, financed and helped create the Taliban and reactionary forces inside of Pakistan and all throughout Africa, even in Nigeria as we speak. They've had the they're responsible for a kind of form of religious imperialism, if you will, with their petrodollars. But back in home, at the very heart of Islam, my understanding is there's much greater diversity that has not been extinguished by the main Wahhabi orthodoxy.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, Wahhabism means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. It's been around for, in one form or another, for since the late 18th century. And it's been tied directly to Saudi political and economic ambitions ever since. And really, I'm not sure we'd be having this conversation about Saudi Arabia, its importance, or about Wahhabism's ability to spread globally and its corrosive influence if it wasn't for the discovery of oil. I mean, the Saudis hit the jackpot. They got lucky. And they got lucky that they discovered this resource, and of course it wouldn't have been discovered, in a moment of, and when the global industrial economy becomes almost entirely dependent upon it. So Wahhabism certainly has enjoyed a heyday over the last 50 or 60 years in Saudi Arabia, and the kingdom has sought to export it. But you're right that as is the case everywhere, I mean, in any place in Saudi Arabia, there is incredible heterogeneity. There's cultural complexity. There's religious complexity. You know, people aren't brainwashed in Saudi Arabia. They believe lots of different things. Sure, there are devout Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia who support the regime and who support the religious institutions and the religious establishment, but there are lots who don't. But for those who don't, the obstacles to mobilization are considerable. There is, again, there's this powerful security apparatus. The Saudis are well-armed, and they're trained in the arts of counter-revolution, mostly by the Americans, but also by other European arms suppliers and militaries. And Saudis are well aware of that. They've watched what's unfolded across the region. And I've written this on a number of different occasions, that if Saudis were inclined to engage in revolutionary politics, and if they wondered what their regime or how their regime would respond to them, they need look no further than Bahrain, where the Saudis played an important role in crushing the uprising, a violent role, but also to Syria. And here's at the heart of the hypocrisy of the Saudi statement about supporting, that you pointed out a few moments ago, Saudi Arabia supporting the overthrow of Assad. The Saudis would respond exactly the same way. And so that's a significant barrier to revolutionary politics, in spite of the complexity. And I think you're absolutely correct that if you could take a safe poll, if you could gauge public opinion, you'd find there's a great deal of disfavor and dislike for the El Saud. Not many people see them as legitimate political rulers in the kingdom.
Let me get a sense, though, of what the big secret in Saudi Arabia is actually how much oil they have. And they're spending tons and tons of money. You've said they got 20% unemployment. They're trying to buy off the young, and obviously every time, in spite of their tensions with Iran, they're profiting from the tensions as the price of gas goes up, largely due to speculation on Wall Street, is my understanding. But the long and the short is we don't know how long their supplies are going to last, and if they don't have what they say they have, aren't they in huge trouble?
Well, they're in huge trouble even if they have what they say they have, right? I mean, so, because the Saudis have a number of domestic economic problems that they have to overcome. One, you mentioned already the growing population. And if we think about what oil states do and how they attempt to manage themselves and how they attempt to manage domestic politics, they take their oil wealth and they redistribute it in the form of social services, right? Whether it's welfare, healthcare, education, building infrastructure, providing direct employment, subsidies, housing, all kinds of other things. That gets very expensive as the population grows. The Saudis also do something else, and they started this in the late 1970s. They began subsidizing domestic industry and agriculture and all kinds of stuff, which required things like water that the kingdom doesn't have, and as well as other resources. So it became very expensive to maintain a national subsidy program, where basically they were underwriting the cost of electricity and water provision and all kinds of other things. But also, Saudi Arabia has over 30 desalination plants in which it draws on Red Sea and Persian Gulf water in order to provide fresh water for agriculture, but also for domestic consumption. Those plants require a considerable amount of energy themselves, right? They generate electricity, but they also require either oil or more likely natural gas to be fueled. So the Saudis, if you see Saudi Arabia, it's a place of a growing population, where the provision of social services are getting more expensive, and that is using a significant portion of its oil production for domestic purposes, oil that it could sell on global markets, it's under tremendous economic pressure. And the reality is the Saudis have to make sure that the floor price of oil, the baseline price of oil, is high enough for them to be able to service all of those competing needs. And right now, that floor price is around $100 a barrel. About 6 years ago, it was $45 a barrel. So the Saudis are under tremendous pressure to keep prices high. The way they manage that is they manufacture scarcity. So here I'll push back a little bit against fears that the Saudis might run out. I don't actually think the Saudis are going to run out of oil in the next 50 or 60 years. I think they've got plenty in the ground. But what they'll do is they'll keep oil from coming to market. They'll limit production. Just a few weeks ago, at the height of, it's an ongoing height, at the crisis with Iran, oil sanctions, worries about Iran closing off the Strait of Hormuz, but also the Obama administration leading an international charge to limit Iran's ability to profit from the sale of oil, what did the Saudis do? They cut production, which had the effect of spiking the price of oil. And that is consistent with the kind of domestic anxiety and domestic problems that they have. So even if oil is not a scarce resource, even if they have plenty, they're under tremendous pressure to make it seem like it's a scarce resource and to jack up the price as high as we will tolerate. And that's the key thing that the Saudis are constantly thinking through and worrying about. What is the maximum price of oil that they can sustain before the West, and the United States in particular, will begin looking for alternative sources of energy?
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Toby Jones.
No, it's good to be with you. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Jones, professor of Middle East history at Rutgers University, and the author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.